I have to listen to a lot of Morissette now. You just got it stuck in my head.
Well, this has been The Gap. I'm Althea. Tammy's here with me. And we will be back next week. A little bit of... Isn't it ironic?
Hit it.
An old man turned 98. He won the lottery and died the next day. It's a black fly in your Chardonnay. It's a death row pardon 2 minutes too late. And isn't it ironic? Don't you think? It's like rain.
Listening to KBOO
Portland. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the second Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Today on Wings, a prominent Afghani journalist tells why and how she became a refugee.
A lot of things happen in different parts of Afghanistan, but there is no news from these provinces. Why? Because we have no journalists there.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Violet Gunda fled her home country, Zimbabwe, years ago due to persecution of journalists, but continued to report on Zimbabwean affairs from exile using remote interviews. Violet is now president of the International Association of Women in Radio and Television, an organization with chapters around the world. One chapter was founded in Afghanistan, where journalists, and especially women journalists, had many problems, ranging from censorship to murder. But since the fall of Kabul to the Taliban, their problems have gravely intensified.
My name is Violet Gunda, and I have a special guest today, my good friend and colleague, Najiba Ayubi, who is the chapter head of the International Association of Women in Radio and TV for Afghanistan, the IWAT Afghanistan chapter, and I am the president of the International Association of Women in Radio and TV. Najiba is also a recipient of the Courage in Journalism Award, and also was named one of the 100 Information Heroes by Reporters Without Borders. The International Association of Women Radio and TV, or IWAT, has spent months trying to help out some of our colleagues to be evacuated from Afghanistan after they received death threats from the Taliban. Various media watchdogs and international organizations, including the Committee to Protect Journalists, the Journalism and Media Center at Oslo Met University, the US Evacuator Allies, and many other friends of IWAT, also tried to help evacuate some of our colleagues. A couple are still stuck in Kabul, while some of those who have managed to escape are still living in desperate conditions in other foreign countries. Today, Najiba speaks to us from the United States of America. Welcome on the program, Najiba.
Thank you, Violet. Let me to say my regards to you and your audience. I'm very glad to be here with you and talking about what we saw during 3 months to reach here to US.
It's good to finally get to talk to you, because the last few months have really been terrible. American troops withdrew from Afghanistan as the Taliban took over control of the country. What followed next was a desperate attempt for many to leave the country in search of freedom and safety. I know, Najiba Ayubi, that you've never really wanted to leave Afghanistan, despite all the dangers and threats to your life. So what made you change, especially, you know, after August 15?
You know, I'm working, this is 20 years or more than 20 years, I'm working in the media field. And in last 18 or 19 years, I'm working with the Kilit Group, which is a nonprofit media house. And during these years, we did a lot of activities, media activities, like investigative reports and also reporting about corruption and many, many negative things, which was in Afghanistan. We work on that. And many times we receive threats from different people during years. As you told, I didn't want to go out from my country, because my country is my love, and I wanted to do something even small for my country. But in 15th of August, when Taliban entered in Kabul, again I decided to not go out from Afghanistan. Some of my friends, they remember when they suggested to me to go out from Afghanistan, I said, no, I want to remain here and I want to play my role as an Afghan woman journalist in Afghanistan. But in the fourth or fifth night when Taliban came to Kabul, it was 19th of August, 9:30 of the evening, a few Talibs came and knocked our door. And we didn't open the door, but we saw in the monitor of our security camera that there were four people and they knocked the door very badly, and we didn't open the door. Then they went and asked from our neighbors why they are not opening the door, and the neighbor said maybe they are not at home. On that night, it was very scary, and it was a very difficult night for all my family members. And then until morning, we were very concerned what will happen during the night. When it became morning, we sat together and we decided to go out, because we didn't know why they came to our house. And we feel scary a little bit, and then we decided to go out. And that is why in 29th of August, I with some of my family members come out from Afghanistan. And finally, after 2.5 months, I reached to US.
Now, Najiba, I know a lot did happen from the time when the Taliban started knocking at your door. Can you at least describe to our viewers what strategy you actually adopted and the harrowing time you had getting on the plane with your family members? Can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, Violet, believe me, I didn't want to go out from Afghanistan, but the situation came like that. We had no way, we have to leave, because we didn't know what will happen. It was a very difficult decision for me. Even we started to go to the airport, entering the airport was another problem, because you know on that time there was thousand people around the airport. The people, they had document or not, all people came around the airport. And we entered to the airport with some coordination, which was there. We were 52 women with our family members, some of them family members, some of them alone. We came together, we entered by car in airport. This was very difficult and scary. The Talib which helped us to enter to the airport, He was very tough, and his colleague was very tough, and they were shouting on us too many. And then they had a list, and they read our name one, and they allow us to go inside the airport. When we entered in the airport, there was two sides. One side was the Taliban, and the other side, which was a line separated these two parts, there was American soldiers. And this Taliban submit the list which was our names. He submitted the list to the American soldier, and the soldier take it, and they allow us to enter to the part that there was airplane and these things. We entered there, and then these people said, you are not allowed to have anything in your hand. They said we had one dress and our telephone and some very small money we had with us. They said you are allowed to take your devices, and also you are allowed to have your money, or if the woman have some jewelry. Other things, if you have other stuff like dress, like very necessary things for washing or for something, you have to put all these things in the garbage. And then they ask everyone to put everything away. And when I arrived to the searching part, there was a woman, soldier. She searched the woman, and the man searched the man. And the woman asked me to give me your bag, handbag, and also your computer bag. I said, why? He said, I don't hear why. This is decision. We have to put all these things to the garbage. And they gave me a plastic bag, very tiny. And they say, gave all this my stuff to the plastic bag, and put my computer bag and my handbag to the garbage. Then we come to the airplane, and we think the airplane will be a airplane which have seat or something. But unfortunately, when we come there, it was cargo airplane. There was no seat at all. And around 400 or 500 people was sitting in the floor of the airplane. And then it had 3 hours flight, and we reached to Doha. In Doha, we went to some camp, which was too many people, around maybe 1,000 people in one like tent, something like a tent. We entered there, the weather was very warm, and they distributed the food. After that, after 9 hours, they asked us to come to the airport again. We want to have another flight. And we went there, this plane was a little bit good, and it had seats, and we sit on the airplane, and it fly to Germany. 1 month we remain in Germany. The Germany camp had also other difficulties. In the beginning, when we went there, it was empty tent with some very tiny soldier beds with no mattresses or nothing. And then the weather was very cold, and the first night, all people which was there, we shake from the coldness. And then all children which was in the tent, they get cold, and they become sick. And they distributed 2 times food, which was very less. And nobody, it was not enough for nobody. Even for the children, it was not enough. And then there was no Wi-Fi and nothing. Our relation, our contact with all my family members and friend was cut. And then I bring 2-3 women with myself, and we went and talked with the head of the camp and with other representative of the camp. We talked with them. We said we need enough food at least, and we need internet. I'm thankful from the leaders of this camp. All these suggestions was accepted with them, and they made the food 3 times, and also they provided internet for us, and also they provided education classes for children and adults, and everything was a little bit good, and also they distributed very good blankets for us, and also they put stoves in the tents, and slowly the situation became a little bit good, and we 1 month we remained there. After that, after 1 month, we come to Virginia camp. It was a camp in a forest by the name of Upshur, Quantico. When we arrived there, there was 6,000 people in the same time in different tents. Again, we went to the tents. The situation was very bad here because in the first tent we were in Germany, there was 2 or 3 family together in one tent. But when we arrived here, 300 people or more than 300 people in some cases. And we had our bed, every family had their beds. Then we cover blankets around the beds. Very difficult time, all the time it was noisy. The noise of the people, the noise of the children, and we had no internet again. The food was not good enough. In this Virginia camp, they gave enough food, but it was not cooked very well. And again, the coldness, we did, again, we started advocacy with the leaders of the camp. And again, they provided stoves and everything.
On Wings, you're listening to an interview with Najiba Ayubi, a prominent Afghani journalist now in exile. She spoke to Violet Gonda, host of the series The Hot Seat, herself in exile, living in the UK.
It was a difficult time, Violet. I don't want to remember all these things I feel during this 2.5 months. But I know it was very, very difficult time.
Yes, I can imagine. And all this time, were you traveling with your family, or it was just yourself and some of the women at risk that had managed to be evacuated at the same time with you?
We were a group of 52 people. They were women activists, they were social workers, some of them was journalists, men and women. Then some of them was worker, officers of government or civil society people, designers, artists. We were a combined group. All of them was with their families, and it was family team. With me, one of my brother and one of my sisters was with me, with their families.
And tell us, Najiba, about how you managed to be part of this group, because I understand that a lot of people would know during this period it was very difficult to evacuate people who needed to be sent to a place of safety, and especially female journalists like you. But how did you then manage to get onto this list? I understand that you had to make a presentation in the White House, a virtual White House presentation, to plead for your immediate evacuation. Who actually stepped in to help?
When the Taliban entered in Kabul, you know, we lost everything, all achievement of 20 years, and it was a very scary time for everyone, and everyone was concerned because there was unclear situation and nobody knows what will happen, because we heard a lot of things that Taliban said there is all non-Muslims in that people are living in Kabul. And we had experience of their government in 20 years back. And people was concerned, and the situation was very scary, and it was like that. And when the evacuation procedure started, I want to talk about this as well, because it had a lot of mistakes. It was not a proper plan for evacuation. the people which was my friends and my colleagues and my organization partners and too many people, including IWART friends, they contacted me and said, what will happen? And all these friends from different parts of the world, they suggested that they can add me in some list to go out from Afghanistan. But believe me, in the beginning, I said, no, I have no plan. But when these Taliban came on the night, they came on our door, I decided to go out. And then after this, then organization contacted me and they said, we have a list of 100 women activists. We want to take them out from Afghanistan. And I said, it is very difficult for me to go alone because I'm not one person, because my family is dependent with me and I'm the head of the family actually. And also my sisters and brothers are in danger because we all living in one house and it is very difficult to remain them alone. And then I send the names and they put us on the plan. And on 29th of August, by very, very difficulties, which we spent around 4 day and night in the car. And the car was on the street of Kabul, around the Serena Hotel and other part of the city. Finally, the coordination happened and we entered in the air.
So, Najib, who actually stepped in to help? Because I understand that mission was part of the Hillary Clinton mission to help women at risk. So was Hillary Clinton personally involved?
I don't know, actually. I heard sometime, but I'm not sure because there was few organization assigned. And I think the main supporter was State Department and some other organization was help them. And I think the Women Affairs Department of the State Department.
Right. And of course, so many women journalists and or so many journalists and women activists are still stranded in Afghanistan. Do you think that world leaders have abandoned the women of Afghanistan?
The evacuation plan was not proper. From the beginning, some mistake happened in the airport when the airplane of US came to the airport. In the beginning, they asked some workers of the airport to come in the airplane. When they come in the airplane without document, without list, without nothing, after these people contacted too many their relatives that there is an opportunity and US want to bring everyone to US. That is why too many people came around the airport and the exact people that they were in the plan and they were in danger and their life was in risk. These people remain. At the same time, some corruption happened because people, some opportunists, they took money and provided document to the people which they were not activists, not journalists, and they provided documents and they showed to the different organization and they put them on the list. There was a very corrupt situation. And that is why a lot of exact people to they have to be out of Afghanistan. Their life is in danger. They remain in Afghanistan. Still, they are there. And I know too many people that they were very active. And I find this disaster when I came to the camp. I saw too many people. They were not even one day activist or one day journalist. I saw how you came. He said, I was in civil society. I work with civil society, but As a woman journalist and as a civil society activist, I didn't see any activities from these people. And that is why it disturbed me a lot. And I find out in the camps that some very big massacre is ongoing, and people with the exact people are not out, but the people which made fake documents, they are here and they come out. These things happen, unfortunately, and that's why now we have a lot of people that must go out from Afghanistan, and they want to go out, or their life is in risk, and still they are remaining. I hope that the organization, the safety committee, NAI, support media, and also some other international organization, I hope they can help these people to go out from Afghanistan. I am very thankful from CPJ that they help some IWARD members and also some colleagues from Kilid Group. They help them to go out with some of their families, and some of them alone. And we hope other organizations which can do something, they do something for Afghan journalists, and especially for men and women, especially for women.
I think that is one of the challenges that I observed when we were dealing with your situation, and also the situation of some of our colleagues, and some of them are still stuck in Afghanistan, is that just watching the way, you know, some of the media watchdogs, like the Committee to Protect Journalists, were, you know, trying to help, you know, journalists like you. But it was also frustrating to see how a lot of the work that was needed was actually out of their control, because yes, they have to rely on governments. They don't actually evacuate journalists. They don't evacuate people. They can help to do the assessments and help with visa applications and other issues like that. But, you know, it's difficult when you're having to deal with governments in this situation. Did you also see the same challenges when you were dealing with media watchdogs?
Yeah, Violet, these things was happen. When by support of IWARD, CPJ asked me to send the name of 10 people, I didn't wrote my name on that time because I wanted to help my colleagues as much as I can. I sent the 10 people of IWARD members to them, but they just was succeed to help 4 or 5 of them. 2-3 of them went with their families out, and 2 of them still are remain in Kabul. But CPJ tried their best, and finally, when I followed this issue of my other colleague which remain in Kabul, they said we have a lot of people in the list, and we work on turn, and with one-to-one, I wanted to help all of them, but it is very difficult because we have too many people in the list. The situation of these organizations are understandable because they were not ready for this kind of situation. Mm. Too many people at the same time, they contacted these organizations. It is understandable because the capacity of this organization was not enough for arranging or doing things for all, help for all these people. I know this is very difficult. If all people come out from Afghanistan, it is also difficult. And we need women and men journalists inside Afghanistan as well to report that the things which happen in Afghanistan. But the life of the people is also very important.
That was part one of Violet Gonda's interview with Najiba Ayubi, a prominent Afghani journalist who recently had to flee the country. Next week on Wings, she tells about her experience with government and Taliban negotiators and her hopes for the future of journalism in Afghanistan.
The Talib said media is very dangerous. They can destroy a government.
Violet Gonda is president of the International Association of Women in Radio and Television. Najiba Ayuba is president of its Afghanistan chapter, a chapter that is now scattered all over the world. A video of this interview is online in the series Hot Seat with Violet Gonda. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose work can be found on the website gifteconomy.com. That's gift-economy.com. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Good morning. This is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder,
board operator.
Before John begins his interview today, I'd like to remind you that you can support programs like ours, Disability Justice, by going to kboo.fm/give.
All right. So with me in the audience today, is in the studio is Kathy and Sue. Would you please introduce yourselves and give me your titles? Can we start with Kathy first, please?
Thank you, John. So my name is Kathy Wenberg. I'm the Deputy Director of Independent Living Resources. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I've been at ILR for 15 years now.
My name is Sue Muse, and I am a options counselor / independent living specialist. I have been at ILR for 3.5 years. Majority of that obviously was during the pandemic. So I am still learning. I'm a transplant from Florida. So I'm still learning about this state and all that it offers.
Let's get right into it. What is independent living resources?
Well, we are an agency made up of people with disabilities, helping people with disabilities to gain greater independence in life. We work with people as far as what their goals are. We're a consumer-driven, consumer-directed agency. So we help people to navigate community resources, to get connected to resources. We want people to learn the skills that they need to become better self-advocates and become part of the community and have equal access and opportunity in the community.
You sound sort of like a peer-to-peer support group.
We're professionals. So many of us become from diverse backgrounds, but we are peers in that we have disabilities. 51% of the people who work for independent living have to identify as having a disability of some sort. Independent Living Resources came out of the independent living movement of the 1960s down in Berkeley. And so it's really about equal access and opportunity and choices in the community. And so we work, we have different groups. We offer a TBI group, which is a traumatic brain injury support group. We help people with transition planning. We help them connect. So if somebody needs, for instance, they need help getting connected with, you know, let's just say other services in the community that might help them, for example, aging and disability services or developmental disability services or, you know, understanding their options for getting, you know, home care support. We can help them understand the options. We are also a partner with the Aging and Disability Resource Connection. And so we provide options counseling through that. We provide skills training around understanding housing options and how to search for housing. You know, unfortunately, we can't find people housing, but we can certainly let them know how to search for it and know what their rights and responsibilities are as tenants, and how to ask for accommodation. We provide peer counseling. A lot of times, you know, somebody may come in and they may have questions about, like, maybe they, you know, have some issues or concern around their disability and work, or maybe they're just trying to adjust or trying to, you know, maybe explore what their life with a disability is going to be like, or what they've experienced as a person with a disability. So where there is peers to help them, you know, model self-advocacy and help people connect to the community. We provide the community information and referral services. Like I said, we provide skills training. Pre-pandemic, we would do more things in person. So right now our building, for instance, is closed to the public. So we're providing services remotely, but in the past we've done things under skills training, like we had a partnership with the Oregon Food Bank. So we had it was called Cooking Matters. So it was cooking on a budget. And so that was kind of a neat program where for 6 weeks they'd come in and the group would learn how to make a meal, and then they'd get the groceries to go home and make the meal themselves for their family or friends. And so that's kind of part of who we are. We want to help people to learn how to be self-advocates, to understand what their rights are and really advocate for right on a systems level. We helped with ODOT to help them make their sidewalks more accessible in partnership with Disability Rights Oregon through a lawsuit. And we work on a national level with the National Council on Independent Living and the State Independent Living Council. And we've been really trying to network with others, and you know, really expand, you know, our reach. We have 7 SILs around the state. We are part of a network of national SILs, I believe around 400 SILs that we have. And we really start where the person's at. It's consumer directed, and we work with all people who identify as having a disability or a significant medical condition.
I'd like to add something to that, if I can. We also have the WIN program, the Work Incentive Network program. We have 3 people that work with people that may be getting Social Security and are looking to go back to work, or maybe supplement their Social Security through working. So those people help them explain what that program entails, what would happen to their benefits. And also we get people calling that are not just disabled, but it's family members of someone who is disabled. So they're calling because they might have a situation, they don't know what to do for this person, they don't know the resources. So we will assist family members and give them answers to their questions so they can then assist the disabled.
It does sound like you all deal with a lot of the basic needs of living. I am wondering, do you deal with anything different basic needs, such as maybe social interaction, dating, hooking up with somebody, or anything else like that? Because I did hear a whole lot about housing and working and dealing with your benefits and stuff like that. And I'm just kind of like wondering, besides just the basic everyday pursuit of survival in a very difficult system, do you also do something like interaction?
Yeah. People are we do. We do, actually. We have a recreation program. But unfortunately, because of COVID, we haven't been able to really do anything because people cannot gather. So we have things for the holidays. It's a big social thing for the holiday, the summer, spring. Everybody gets together at the building at Christmas time. They get gifts. There's music. There's food. In the summertime, we have met at the golf course. And we had a picnic there. I came in right before COVID, so I remember some of this. Kathy can elaborate on it. But I also know through counseling things come up in the counseling we do, that they do talk about relationships. They do talk about things they're dealing with on a personal level. And we do listen, we support them. And if we feel there's a need for more extended therapy or to refer for something, then we give them that referral as well.
I would say also that we, you know, in the past we had like a kind of a mindfulness group where we had a wonderful mindfulness teacher that kind of teach some relaxation and some stress management. We, in the past, we've offered something called Healing Pathways, which is a group for people who identify as female, who may have experienced trauma in their life, and we're unable to offer that right now due to funding, but we have offered those kind of groups. And we have our traumatic brain injury group, which is a wonderful group for people who have experienced traumatic brain injuries, and that is continuing on remotely.
Okay. I was wondering, you know, I heard that you guys are promoting self-advocacy and stuff like that, and I'm wondering, is there anything you are currently advocating on? And when I say currently advocating on, you know, like something like big, not, I mean, you know, there's probably a lot of small applications going on always with independent living resources, but I'm kind of like wondering, is there anything like big you guys might be pushing at the state level or the county level or the city level or even the federal level?
So one of the big things that we're working on right now is that we're trying to really advocate for more affordable subsidized housing for people with disability and expanding access to transportation and community systems. We work closely with other organizations to do that. And, you know, the Area Agencies on Aging and the ADRC. But one of the biggest challenges and one of the most requested need right now that ILR is getting is housing. And not affordable housing isn't always subsidized housing, and people get that so confused. Just because something's affordable doesn't mean that it's going to be affordable to somebody on a fixed income, you know. So a subsidized unit is, it typically goes between 30 to 50% of someone's income. You know, an affordable unit might, for example, instead of like a market rate, which might be $1,300 a month, an affordable unit might be $800 a month. But if you only receive, you know, $841 in Social Security, that unit is not going to be affordable. And it's not going to be affordable to a lot of people. And so what we're really trying to advocate for is subsidized housing so that people can live, be safe, and have a warm place to be and be able to afford the necessities of life. I mean, we are living in a time where inflation and, you know, people are struggling, and lots of units are going up, but not enough subsidized units are going up.
May I just put in one other word? Somebody recently used the word livable. Just because a place is affordable doesn't always necessarily mean it's livable.
Yes.
And so that's definitely another one of those things when it comes to subsidized housing that they really need to throw in there is livable. And I'm just kind of curious, housing is definitely not just an issue here in Portland. Mm-hmm. It's probably all over the state. So are you also working with other independent living resource centers in other states to, help you all out with the advocacy on the finding the affordable, accessible, livable housing?
We're working on a national level with NICL and with the Association of Rural Independent Living Centers on this issue, and also the other seven centers around Oregon. It is an issue throughout the state of Oregon as well. So yes, we certainly are.
Yeah, I would like to add to that as well that I have had several consumers that we've worked with move out of this state into another state. and they are disabled. So we work with the states they're moving to try to get some services set up prior to the move. Of course, the centers in the state that they're moving to, they're very accommodating. You know, we work together on trying to get them the best fit before they even make that move.
So I would take it that this advocacy is also at the federal level, as well as I mean, you know, I've heard that you guys are out there at the rural areas of the state of Oregon, but I'm like also wondering, is this also something you consider, all the other organizations you just mentioned that you're working with, are they also working at the federal level to deal with this problem as well?
I've gotten involved with the Office of Public Management in the White House, and they were very interested in my thoughts on, you know, things that the disabled run up against. I think you have a new administration now in the White House, and I feel they're more open to hearing what needs to be said about what the disabled are dealing with. And she actually, it's interesting because we had a meeting and there was no closed caption at the meeting. And so I wrote her an email later and said, you know, you're working with the disabled, but there's no closed caption. And she profusely apologized. And the next meeting, there was closed caption. But I also think on a federal level, we do get some of our funding from the federal government, which enables us to have support in the programs that we offer, because some of those programs, Kathy, are federally paid for programs, yes. Right?
Yes. And I would say, yeah, it is a federal issue that, you know, the National Association of Centers for Independent Living is interested in, because it, affordable, subsidized, accessible housing, universal accessibility is so important. And many times what we see happening is somebody will say, oh, yes, my unit is accessible, but it's not completely accessible. You know, they may have forgotten about turning radiuses, or even like, you know, the bathroom might not be fully accessible, or it may not have the equipment that is needed for the person to be able to live there safely. And so we teach people is like what their rights are as a tenant to request those accommodations, you know, but of course we always want to advocate that everything should be universally accessible so that people with disabilities can enjoy the community and the world, you know, anywhere that they travel or need to go or to live.
Obviously you're advocates, but I was just kind of curious, when you are dealing with your property managers, do you guys have any authority over any of this stuff?
I mean, we don't have any authority over shelters or housing, but we can certainly let people know what their rights are. And if they need more support, a lot of times legal aid, or, you know, there's other housing advocacy organizations that might be able to help. I can write letters of support sometimes if needed. That's our role. It's really an area where I wish more people understood reasonable accommodation. I wish that landlords were more educated on that, and some are, so, you know, but there's still a long way to go. And even just understanding your rights as an employee, understanding there's just so much that I feel like there's so many areas of advocacy for people with disabilities that we still have to work on. Definitely one of the bigger areas right now, I think, because of the housing crisis and the housing shortage is housing. And we are very short on accessible housing. So knowing what your rights are is very important as a tenant.
I think too that if people don't have safe housing, they can't work on all their other needs in life because they're too busy trying to survive from day to day. They don't have a safe place to rest their head. They don't have, you know, a safe place that's their own, and they're just trying to get by day to day. So I think, and that's hard enough being disabled as it is. So I think that there really, my hope is that there would be an intense effort made for housing for the disabled specifically, so they can be in a safe place, because the disabled are taken advantage of on a good day. so that they could be in a safe place where they're getting their housing needs met, maybe case management, you know, that they can then handle everything else in their life, but they know at the end of the day, they have a place that they can go home and be safe.
Build a Movement is something that people with intellectual disabilities has been doing 4 years now. This year, we decided that it would be a good idea to, because oftentimes when it comes to people with disabilities and people with intellectual disabilities, the government likes to kind of like put two funding areas rather than just one funding area. So they pit us against each other. I don't really like that at all. But in Build a Movement, you know, we're trying to bring the legislators in to hear what our problems are in the hopes that maybe someday they'll actually do something about it. People with disabilities often have the same troubles as people with intellectual disabilities. Yeah. The only problem is we're set in two different funding areas, which often winds up meaning we compete towards against each other instead of where we need to be competing towards, which is saying, hey, stop pitting us together or pitting us against each other and, you know, listen to what our needs are, because a lot of them are very much the same.
Yeah. As a world, we have to figure out what a human right is. And you're right. I absolutely, because we are all affected. We may have different needs, but we all have, you know, we all want to live in the community. We all want equal access. We all want to be safe. We all have the same basic needs. It shouldn't be that, oh, we're fighting over pots of money. We need to be living in a community where just universally accessible and recognizing that we're all humans and what a basic human right is, helping people to live as independently as they can in the community and have dignity and worth and respect, because everybody deserves that, right? Mm-hmm. They deserve to be safe. They deserve to be happy, or at least to be able to pursue happiness. And I feel like for people with disabilities, that's always been a struggle of like, we have to, oh, you want to live in the community? Okay, well, you have to make it work. We're not going to make that easy for you. You know, and that is kind of how the Center for Independent Living came about, when Ed Roberts decided he wanted to go to college. And at 14, he acquired polio, and he ended up in an iron lung. He made it through school, and he decided he wanted to go to college. So the college accepted him, but it was the only place that could house him was the school infirmary. So the school medical center, and so that's where he was. But then he would try to get to his classes, and the sidewalks weren't accessible. And so, you know, he was out there with some friends with jackhammers, you know, after he got the law changed. So what they said was, you know, with advocacy, the city said, well, we'll just replace the sidewalks as needed. And when they come up and they're bad, we'll just replace them and we'll put the curb cuts in. Well, that could take 20, 30, 50 years. So he went out with jackhammers with his friends, and they were there jackhammering the streets. And I'm not saying that that's what people, but I'm saying that's what it took for him to get accessible sidewalks. And I think we have to look at people and say, everybody deserves to live in the community and be part of the community and how they define it and how they are able. What we try to do is make our, as much as we can, our corner of what we can affect with legislature and advocacy and helping people to become better self-advocates, to, you know, get the resources and support they need while we're trying on a larger level to advocate for the services and supports.
I was very impressed with the group of people that I met in the Build a Movement meetings that I attended. Very resilient, very determined, had a lot to say. I was just impressed with what you all are trying to do. The fact that some legislature people agreed to come and hear what was said, I don't know if any of them acted on it, what was told to them. Yeah. So I think you have to keep going with it.
Yeah.
And I know that we at ILR would be very agreeable to being a part of this.
Yes.
I'm just waiting to hear when the next meeting is. So I know that we would offer our services in any way we could to be able to get something moving, like you said, yeah. and make people understand that they cannot keep pitting us against each other for funding, that we're all in this together. If there is anything that you feel we could aid with, please reach out and let us know.
Absolutely. I mean, we work with everybody. We serve all communities, and we are a true cross-disability organization that if you identify as having a disability or a medical condition, we will provide services. What you're doing with BAM and just talking to the legislature is so important, because our voices need to be at the table. We need to be heard. If we're not out there and we're not advocating and we're not on all levels, you know, on individual levels, but also, you know, in systems level, in government, I don't want to be forgotten. I don't want people to be forgotten, you know, so it's really important to continue the movement, because we have so much more to do. You know, disability is it's a group that anybody can join at any point, you know, due to an unfortunate accident or an illness or an injury. I think that we need to work on making our world more just universally accessible.
ILR has gone to Salem as a group, and we've taken some of our clients with us to advocate regarding laws that are being considered. So we are familiar with making our presence known in Salem, and I know we will do it again if the need came up.
Does that mean you guys have an advocacy committee?
Well, we have our ILR advocacy committee on the first Monday of each month at 1:30. That's open to anybody that would like to join. Right now it's virtual.
What is the best way to like contact your guys' organization?
So you can call us, also email.
The phone number for us.
Yeah, it's, phone number, please.
Yeah,
phone
yes. 503-232-7411.
And you guys got a website or?
We do. It's www.ilr.org. And if you Google independent living resources, you'll find us on Google.
Thank the two of you for coming in. Well, actually, for joining me on Zoom and for talking to me.
Thank you so much for having us. And it's been a pleasure to join you today.
Mm-hmm. You know.
Welcome. Dear KBOO listeners, I would first like to say thank you to KBOO for giving a voice to those of us who do not have a voice. And so far as I know, the only one who has done this for our community. Please support them as they support us.
You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give. You can also click donate in mobile app or text KBOO to 44-321.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kboo.org.
Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
What would KBOO be without its more than 300 volunteers? They support the station with everything, and now they need someone to support them. KBOO is looking for a community organizer who would bolster and empower our volunteers. Are you the right person, or do you know someone who is? Then go to kboo.fm to learn more about the essential functions of the volunteer coordinator and the qualifications we're looking for. To apply, please email your resume and cover letter to hiring@kboo.org by Sunday, March 6 at midnight. You can also apply by mailing your resume and cover letter to KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97215.